Are you from here? Freckles asked. She hadn't recognized them. No, Holden said. Our ship's in the dock. Our old ship, anyway. The one we came in on. And the crew we flew with. Mine's in lockdown, too, Freckles said. The old Buncombe, out of New Roma. We were slated to go home next week. I don't know where we're going to stay now. Not on your ship? She shook her head. The docks are off limits. No one's allowed on their ships without escort. I'm hoping we can find rooms, but I've heard we may have to camp out here in the drum. Naomi turned, and he saw everything that he was thinking mirrored in her face. If the docks were off limits, and the crews turned out, the others wouldn't be on the Rossi. And with the network down, they couldn't put through a connection request. They didn't have any way of contacting Bobby or Alex or Amos or Clarissa. Counting each deck and the inner surface of the drum, it was something over 50 square kilometers of hallways, cabins, access tubes, and warehouses, recycling plants, hydroponic farms, air storage, medical bays, a maze the size of a small city, and somewhere in it, four people he needed to find. Holden coughed out a small, harsh laugh. Naomi tilted her head. Nothing, he said. It's just not very long ago. I was thinking how small Medina felt. Chapter 18. Bobby. A rope defined the line to the ships. 2.5, maybe 300 people, each with their fist on it, went the length of the dock and switched back twice. Men and women in jumpsuits of dozens of different companies jostled in place in the dock's microgravity, inching forward along the line as if registering their silent impatience would make the whole operation move faster. Laconian guards floated along the perimeter, rifles drawn and ready for violence. If it came to that, Bobby thought, it wouldn't be surgical. Not in a mob like this. If anyone started anything, the air recyclers would be spitting out blood clots for months. She hoped everyone else knew that, too. She hoped they cared. Every now and then, a team of Laconian military escorts came, took the people from the moored end of the line, checked their authorization, screened them for weapons, and led them off to their ship. Everyone on the rope would pull a little forward, grabbing on another half-meter closer to their turn, feeling the weave of the strands, the grease from all the palms before their own. The unmoored end floated free, waiting for the next hapless crew to join the waiting horde. They were lucky, Bobby told herself. Most of the ships had full crews of 20 or 30 people. The Rossi just had the four of them. They could all go aboard at once. Small blessings, indeed. Almost too small to see. The guards led away another group. They moved down the rope again, that much closer. How are you holding together, Claire? Bobby asked. Clarissa took a long, shuddering breath and nodded. When she spoke, the words came out just a little too fast, and all the consonants had sharp edges, like she was trying to rein them in and couldn't. It would be very nice to get to the medbay, but right now it's just euphoria and nausea. Nothing I can't handle. That changes, Amos said. You let me know.
Will,
she said. Bobby wasn't sure she liked the sound of that. There weren't many actions Amos could take that would make the situation better. If putting their heads down and enduring wasn't enough to get Clarissa to her medications, the options got bad fast.
Anyone else think it's cold in here? Alex said.
It is, Clarissa said. I think the pressure's a little low, too. The environmental systems are all off.
That doesn't sound like a good thing, Alex said.
Belters, Bobby said. We trained for this.
You trained for low air pressure?
Amos asked. He sounded amused. That was better than sounding frustrated. We trained for occupying Belter stations. One of the base tactics that Belters used was throwing environmental stasis off just enough that we'd have to keep bumping it up our priority queue. Someone somewhere on this station is trying to make it harder for these folks.
Huh, Amos said. That's pretty ballsy.
It only works if the occupying force isn't willing to just kill everyone and start over. So, yeah, there's an element of playing chicken. The group in front of them on the rope wore gray-black jumpsuits with Charles Boyle gas transport logos in green on the back. The one floating nearest them looked back over his shoulder, catching Bobby's eye almost shyly. She nodded, and the man nodded back, hesitated, tilted his head a centimeter forward.
Perdo, he said, nodding toward Clarissa. La hija, la. She's sick.
Bobby felt herself tense. It wasn't a threat. It wasn't an insult. It was just someone who wasn't part of her crew putting themselves into her business. But maybe she was feeling as tense as Amos. She took a little breath and nodded. The man tapped his compatriot ahead of him on the rope. They spoke for a moment in Belter cant so thick and fast Bobby couldn't follow it. Then they all released the rope and gestured Bobby forward, giving up their place in line so that Clarissa could get to the Rossi a few minutes sooner. It was a tiny thing, a gesture. It shouldn't have hit her as hard as it did.
Thank you, Bobby said, and ushered the others forward. Thank you very much.
Easy's, the man said, waving her thanks away. It wasn't an idiom she'd heard before, but his expression explained it. We do what we can for each other. The Laconians were efficient. The line moved quickly. Even with as many people as were waiting, the Rossi crew reached the head of the line in only a couple of hours. An escort of four Marines checked her authorizations, scanned them all for weapons. Apart from a momentary hit of panic when they were looking at Clarissa's scan, would her modifications keep them from letting her on? Everything went smoothly. And after all, her mods had been designed to get past security unnoticed. Good to know they were still doing their jobs, even while they killed her. The Rocinante was waiting for them in the dock, loyal as a dog. When they cycled the airlock and pulled themselves in, Bobby felt her shoulders relax. The air smelled familiar. It wasn't even a particular scent so much as a sense of rightness, of being home. Bobby let herself imagine they were getting on board to leave, that they'd be burning for one of the gates, diving down toward one sun or another. Someday, maybe. Not now.
You have 1 hour. The escort lead said.
Bobby shook her head.
My mechanic needs to be in the med bay for longer than that. She has to have a blood flush. She'll have to do the best she can in an hour. She can visit medical facilities on the station.
Bobby looked at the guard. The man had a wide face and skin just a shade darker than Bobby's own. A lifetime of habit mapped out how Bobby would try disarming him, controlling his weapon, getting into cover. Chances weren't great. The Laconians moved like they'd been well trained, and the oldest of them still looked to be hauling around a decade less than she was.
It's fine, Captain, Clarissa said. I can set the system to do a fast push and get blockers. I've done it before.
If you need another waiver, the guard said, you can apply for it once you've left.
Fine, Bobby said. Let's get on with this.
They moved through the ship like they were visiting someone in prison. The guards went with them everywhere, examined everything they took from their cabins, watched every command they gave the ship, copied every report the ship returned. The resentment in Bobby's gut ached, but there wasn't anything to be done about it. Their pass allowed them to retrieve personal items and any tools they needed for their work, provided they didn't present a security risk. Which was a shame.
There was a part of her that would have liked to explain that she worked as a mercenary, so that she could walk out of here with Betsy around her like a shell. As she packed her things from the captain's cabin, her guard watching wordlessly from the doorway, she opened a connection to Alex.
"What's the good word?" she said.
"Rosie's a little bored, but she's in good condition," Alex said from the flight deck. "A little impurity in the water supply we should look at, but it's likely just a seal that's wearing out. A little stray leaching."
"Okay," Bobby said. She wanted to stay. She wanted to spend her hours polishing her ship and fixing every flaw they could put hands to. She had 35 minutes left.
"Flag it. We'll dig in next time."
"Next time, Captain,"
Alex agreed. Because there would be a next time. Even if there wasn't, they were going to pretend there would be. She locked down her cabinets, checked the message queue from the ship's system to make sure everything was getting to her hand terminal, or at least that the Laconian sensors were locking everything down equally, and pulled herself back down the corridor and toward the lift.
"This a Martian ship?" her guard asked.
"It is," Bobby said as they reached the lift and headed down for the machine shop.
"I've seen some like her back home. First Fleet had a lot like this."
First Fleet, meaning all the ships that Duarte had stolen when he'd escaped to Laconia. But also, Bobby realized, meaning there was a Second Fleet. One with ships like the monstrosity that had killed the Tory Byron.
"Must look pretty quaint, eh?"
she said, trying to make light of it, inviting the guard to give something away. But if there had been an opportunity there, she'd missed it. In the machine shop, Amos had almost finished collecting a set of safety-approved tools in a small ceramic box. He nodded to her as she floated in, stopping herself on a handhold. She saw his sign again.
"You take care of her, she takes care of you."
The words had more weight now. She'd barely had a chance to take care of the Rosinante, at least not as her captain. She hoped another chance would come.
"You ready to roll out?" she asked.
"Yep," Amos said.
Clarissa and Alex were already in the airlock with their guard when Bobby and Amos got there. Clarissa looked more relaxed, and there was more color in her skin. Alex would have seemed relaxed to anyone who didn't know him, but Bobby saw how he looked at the ship, how his hand lingered on the bulkhead. He knew as well as she did that there was no guarantee they'd ever be back. The guards escorted them along the nearly empty docks, back toward the transfer point to the drum and spin gravity, then went back for the next crew to the next ship. When they were alone, Bobby cleared her throat.
"All right. How did that go?" she asked.
"They've locked her down pretty tight," Alex said. "But they didn't get everything. Give me 20 minutes, I can probably get her working."
"I've got a decent kit," Amos said, holding up the toolbox. "Could get some low-level work with just this. Not cutting through any decking, though."
"Claire?"
Clarissa smiled and shrugged. "I feel a little better, and I've got enough blockers." Bobby put a hand on her thin shoulder.
"We'll take care of you," she said.
"I know you will," Clarissa said.
"All right, then," Bobby said. "The way I see it, the next step is find someone who can get messages back to the Union, or Earth-Mars. See if there's anyone out there with a plan, or if we're going to have to make one up on our own."
"We can do that," Amos said. "It shouldn't be hard."
"You sure?" Alex said. "This is Medina Station under occupation by a bunch of splinter Martian military expats. It's not Baltimore."
Amos's smile was as placid as always.
"Everywhere is Baltimore."
Bobby had known and worked with Amos Burton for years, and he kept being able to surprise her. For the next 2 days, Amos took the lead,
moving through Medina Station apparently without any particular aim or purpose. They went to sit in a bar by the water recycling plant, went to interview with a pop-up service that was matching people who'd been locked off their ships with accommodations, played a little dirt football with a crew of technicians whose old split-circle OPA tattoos had been softened and smudged by the years. Every now and then, Bobby caught something, a phrase or a gesture, that didn't quite feel right. Like there was a second conversation going on at some frequency her ears couldn't pick up. She took up her position at Amos's back and watched for threats, either from the Laconians or the locals. Everywhere they went, the station seemed to be on the edge of something. It was in the air and the voices of everyone they spoke to. Guards in power armor, checkpoints. The Laconians had erected an open-air jail and filled it with men and women living behind bars like animals at a particularly shitty zoo. With hand terminals locked down and the internal communications network restricted to the point of uselessness, every conversation seemed fraught and dangerous. "Anything worth encrypting is worth not putting on a network in the first place," Amos would sometimes say. Bobby had never really thought about how much communication changed when every time you spoke, you had to be close enough that the other person could stab you if they wanted to. Never before, anyway. And then, after 3 days, the old belter who'd been the opposing goalie at their football game came to them at the little public table where they were eating mushrooms and noodles, nodded to Amos, and walked away. The big man got up, stretched his neck until it popped, and turned to Bobby. "We've got a thing," he said. "A good one or a bad one?" she said. "One or the other." Bobby took a last mouthful of her breakfast, chewed and swallowed. "Understood," she said. "Let's go." Clarissa and Alex stood when she did. Part of her wanted to order them to stay back. If things went south, they'd be safe. As if anywhere was safe. She didn't say anything. The old belter led them to an access corridor with a ramp that sank down, out toward the skin of the drum and the emptiness beyond it, the void always just underfoot. They passed 2 different concealed guard posts that she saw, and while she didn't think there were any others that had escaped her notice, she couldn't be sure. The old belter didn't say anything, and Amos didn't try to strike up a conversation. The warehouse they ended up in was half filled with storage boxes fixed to the deck with maglocks. The lighting was harsh, restricted wavelength work lights with a flicker that made her feel like her vision was strobing if she moved her hand too quickly. 3 men leaned on the crates, their arms loose at their sides so they wouldn't have to spend the quarter second uncrossing them if things came to violence. Bobby felt a warmth in her gut, a presentiment of trouble that was almost welcome. Invading ships with unimaginable weapons, protomolecule technology that could rip atoms apart, sudden empires imposed without warning or precedent. She'd grit her teeth and move forward, because there wasn't another option. But thugs in warehouses was territory she understood. The man in the middle of the 3 was a belter, tall and muscular. His skin was the same brown as his hair and eyes. Even if he hadn't been pretty, he'd have been striking. And he was pretty.
"Heard you wanted to talk," he said.
Amos looked back at her and pointed to the pretty man with his chin. He'd gotten them this far, but she was the boss. This was hers now.
"Who'd you hear we wanted to talk to?"
Bobby asked, stepping forward. Clarissa shifted out to her side. As weak and compromised as she looked, they'd underestimate her. Bobby didn't know what using the implants would do to Clarissa, but by the time it took its toll, all 3 of the men would be incapacitated or dead.
and that was without her and Amos weighing in. The pretty man tilted his head.
Names are dangerous, Koyo, he said.
Bobby pointed a thumb to herself.
Captain Bobby Draper.
She turned to the others. Alex Kamal, Clarissa Mao, Amos Burton.
Now who the fuck are you?
The pretty man scowled, tilting his head like he was trying to recall a song that was just at the edge of memory. It was a look she'd seen before, and she didn't feel like helping him place her. Not yet, anyway.
Saba,
the man said at last. And that's enough for you right now.
You're playing this all pretty close to the chest, Saba, Bobby said.
Not interested in being under the authority of the authorities, he said. I've got reasons for that.
Well, I'm not working for Laconia, so we can stop the bullshit, right?
Not sure we can, Saba said. His hand terminal chimed. A sound Bobby didn't remember hearing since the crackdown, but he ignored it. Interesting that he had a working hand terminal, though. The chances that he was the real deal went up in her estimation.
Heard you were looking to get in touch with the underground, Saba said.
Leaves a man wondering why.
You looking to trade with a new boss?
Nope, Bobby said.
Then you thinking you're coming to tell us what to do?
Bobby smiled. She could feel her teeth against her lips. Either they were going to back each other down, or this was going to end in blood. She hoped it was the former, but it wasn't her call.
We were there when that fucking idiot tried to kill the governor.
If that's the level you people are working at, then yes, I'd be happy to help organize. Someone ought to. Saba's face was cool.
Belter's been standing under the oppressor's boot for generations.
You think you've got something to teach us?
Apparently so, Bobby said. Seems like some of you assholes have gotten pretty rusty.
A little darkness came to Saba's olive cheeks. He stood up, stepped forward. Bobby took her own step in to meet him. If she showed weakness now, they'd never take her seriously again. The chirp of his hand terminal seemed to come from another universe.
What? Bobby said, not giving him the tempo. You planning to do this without any allies? Without any support? You against the Laconian Empire? I've seen how that went up till now, and...
Saba! The new voice came from behind her. She didn't want to turn her back on the three belters, but she didn't want someone unknown at her back either.
Saba!
The voice said again. It sounded young, excited. Bobby threw a glance over her shoulder. A young woman in a green jumpsuit, grinning like someone had just given her a present.
Que, Nanda?
Saba asked.
Found someone, the girl said. Look!
And from behind the girl, Holden and Naomi came into the room, squinting at the ugly light.
Hey, Holden said.
And then,
Bobby, this is great. I wasn't sure how we were going to find you.
Saba whistled low.
James fucking Holden. You'll no believe how much I've heard about you.
All good, I hope, Holden said, walking forward, oblivious to the tension in the room, or maybe choosing to ignore it. It was always hard to tell with him.
You've met my old crew already?
Your crew? Saba said. Then looked at Bobby as if seeing her for the first time. He laughed.
Savvy, I did. Well then, welcome to the underground.
She smiled, but something ugly plucked at her guts. James fucking Holden, Bobby thought. Three magic words, and just like that, someone else was in charge. Chapter 19. Drummer. The image was grainy, the sound almost as much noise as signal. half a dozen encryption layers, poured on and then stripped back out, left their artifacts in the flattened audio and near false colors. Drummer's heart softened all the same, because there in the middle of it, unmistakably, was Saba. His eyes had the little puff at the lower lid that he got when he was tired, but his smile was luminous.
"No savvy you how good it was to get your message, Kami," he said. "Heart outside my body, you are. And no one better than us two to be where we're sitting."
"I love you too," she told the screen, but only because no one else was in her office. Abasarala's covert contacts had come through faster than Drummer had hoped. That they'd come through at all was something of a shock. She had been willing to believe the old woman was overstating her powers, claiming a level of influence that retirement and age had long since taken from her. But here was evidence that whatever else she was, Christian Abasarala wasn't completely full of shit. Saba had burrowed deep into Medina Station like a tick, making connections with as many Union operatives as he safely could, and by Union, more often than not, he meant OPA. She listened and took notes by hand as he went through his full report. Writing it out helped her to remember. 68 people on Medina Station broken into independent cells that went from 3 to 8. The amateur, botched assassination, and the crackdown that followed. Saba didn't have to say that he was using it to recruit more for his effort. That was obvious. The focus moving forward was intelligence gathering and infrastructure. Avasarala's network was all well and good, but having multiple backups, blind zones in the station where the Laconian security couldn't reach, and opening back doors into the communications of the enemy were how to prepare for the next wave, and find out what the next wave was going to be. Drummer found herself nodding with his words, thinking through their implications. The Laconians were routing their comms through a destroyer-sized ship docked on Medina with heavy encryption and an off-ship decrypt local to the station to physically isolate the two. No good way to gather intelligence there, and no chance of breaking into the enemy's system. She'd need to find the firmware code for the antennas and repeaters. Maybe Avasarala's henchmen in the Earth-Mars coalition had some exploits they'd been sitting on that she could pass on to Saba. The Laconian checkpoints were tying up a third of their ground force. That kept the soldiers busy in the known and public corridors and gave Saba's people more time to create bolt holes and blind zones. If the crackdown slacked off, they'd want to do something provocative to keep the enemy busy with identity checks and traffic control. Trivial security theater, while the underground dug more tunnels into the body of the station. It was possible that all the updated plans for Medina were in Laconian hands. Any known holes they had to assume were known to all the players, but making new ones wouldn't be hard for Saba. He understood smuggling as well as she ever had, and maybe better. The message ended with Saba's impish grin.
"You watch you, Medil," he said, and blew a kiss to the camera. "Live like you're dead."
Drummer touched the screen, as if it were his cheek, but it was cold and hard. "Live like you're dead." There was a phrase she hadn't heard in a long time. Once it had been the motto of the Voltaire Collective, a call to courage with a fatalistic bravado that angry adolescents found romantic. She'd found it romantic once, too. She checked the time. Saba's message had run almost 20 minutes. Part of her found it hard to believe it had been that long. She could have drunk in the sound of his voice for another hour and still been thirsty. From her screen after screen after screen of written notes, it was astonishing that he'd fit so much information into so short a time. She went through all she'd written again, committing it to memory, then wiped her notes. Information couldn't be compromised if it didn't exist. She put in a comm request for Vaughn. He answered immediately. "Where do we stand with the military attaché?" she asked.
"Waiting on word from you, ma'am," Vaughn said.
"Have them in the conference room in 10 minutes.
"Yes, ma'am," Vaughn said.
There was a surreptitious pleasure in his voice. The diplomats and coordinators from the Earth-Mars Coalition had been flooding into people's homes since the fall of Medina, and Vaughn enjoyed telling them what to do. It was probably a vice, but she didn't mind indulging it.
Drummer rose from her desk and stretched. Her spine popped once between her shoulders loudly. She yawned, but not from fatigue. It was the kind of yawn that a runner made before a race. The deep inhalation of someone anticipating great effort. If she'd been keeping a normal schedule, her watch would almost be over. That wasn't how she lived anymore. Now she was awake when she needed to be awake, and asleep when she could. Sin Ritma, they'd called that lifestyle back when she'd been younger. It was harder on her body now, and it took an extra bulb of coffee to sharpen her mind sometimes, but it also left her smiling in a way she didn't wholly understand. Benedito Laughlin, the EMC liaison, was waiting for her 20 minutes later. His fist was closed around a bulb of soda water that was already half-collapsed. His wide, toad-like face looked less smug than usual.
"Madam President," he said, standing. Drummer waved him back down. As she sat, Vaughn brought her a bulb of tea. She took a sip, hot but not scalding. Vaughn drifted back to the wall like he was part of the ship's machinery.
"What are we looking at?" Drummer said.
Laughlin cleared his throat.
"Candidly, I think you're going to be quite happy with the plan."
"Are you giving me direct control over your fleets?" He blinked.
Well, that's..."
Drummer smiled.
"I'll probably still be okay with it.
What do you have?"
He took out a hand terminal and threw the data onto the conference room wall. The solar system unfolded before them. Nothing quite to scale, of course. Space was too huge and too empty for that. The fleets of Earth and Mars and the Transport Union were all outlined, location and vector for everything in transit, planetary body and orbital period for everything else. All of it tracked through time. Nothing was ever at rest. And on the edge of the system, hell and gone from anything, the gate where the enemy would arrive.
"Given what we know about the enemy battleship," Laughlin began, "we have worked up several scenarios that we think will give our combined forces the best tactical advantage. The first, of course, being to interrupt it in transit."
"Walk me through it," Drummer said.
For the next 2 hours, Drummer reviewed scenario after scenario after scenario. Laughlin made his case for each of them. Another person like him was with every member of the Union Board, making all the same arguments. Soon the debates would start. With the Void Cities, the Union had a fleet at least as powerful as the EMC. If Saba could make contact with ships in the colonies, it might be possible to coordinate attacks on the slow zone, no matter what Avasarala thought. If not, there was local action to be done on Medina that might be just as good or better. Time after time, his plans came back to the same thing. Protecting Earth, protecting Mars, keeping the Inners from being disrupted, no matter what the cost. Her guess was that the board would see the same thing she did. And then... she hadn't wanted to be a police force for the 1300 worlds. She certainly hadn't wanted to lead a military. But with every new twist, every tactical suggestion, she heard the imagined voices of the board, of Secretary General Lee, of Avasarala. It wouldn't work. Someone was going to have to take charge. And she didn't see many scenarios where that wasn't her. Thank you, she said, when the last of the imagined battles had played out on her monitor. I appreciate your time. Let me confer, and we'll talk again in the morning. Thank you, Madam President, he said as Vaughn escorted him out of the room. As soon as he was gone, she pulled up the scenarios, paging through them all again without him. They'd considered mining their side of the gate with a wall of high-yield nukes, but abandoned it because no one was really sure if the ring could be damaged or not. A safer plan was a series of ships looping up above the ecliptic, doing a high burn and dumping gravel that could make a stone veil over the mouth of the gate. She would be able to control when there were gaps that allowed passage, and when any ship making transit would step into a shotgun blast. And it would last until they ran out of reaction mass and gravel. It was a belter tactic, another gift from the old days. She thought about putting the idea in her response to the EMC, but the truth was she didn't need their permission. And the Void City Independence was close enough to the gate that if they went on the burn now, they could have something in place before the board even finished debating. Drummer let her head sink into her hands. Her neck ached, and a deep, vague craving bothered her, something like thirst, but without a clear sense of what could slake it, if anything could. She heard the door open behind her, but she didn't bother looking up. Whoever it was, she didn't care. And anyway, it would only be Vaughn. Madam President, Vaughn said. Yeah? Something's come through you should probably see. Something wonderful that's going to fill my life with joy? No. She sat up, waving one hand in a circle. Get on with it. There's been a new transmission from Medina, Vaughn said. On the official feeds. More threats and posturing from Laconia? Or have they made the war official? Neither one, Vaughn said, and took the monitor focus. A simple video feed of a podium in front of a few tiers of chairs. Drummer was a little surprised by the simple blue curtains at the back. She'd expected more imperial pomp. A signa romanum with a double-headed eagle. The chairs were filled with people meant to look like journalists, whether they were or not. Carrie Fisk walked into the frame and took her place at the podium. Drummer felt her mouth go hard. "Thank you all for coming today," Fisk said, nodding to her audience. She gathered herself. Looked out, then down again. Since its creation, the Association of Worlds has been a staunch advocate of independence and planetary sovereignty. As such, we have tracked issues of self-rule in the newly colonized systems and fought for the rights of people living on them. The hegemonic power of Sol System and the Transport Union have proven, time and again, that those in power have valued the systems unequally. Sol and the Union have claimed a de facto sovereignty over what they have, through their actions, made clear they consider second-class planets and governments. Oh, fuck you, Drummer murmured. Fuck you and your quizzling bullshit. I have had the opportunity to meet several times with the representatives of the Laconian system about the future of the Ring Gates and the nature of commerce and governance between the worlds. And I am very happy to be able to say that the Association of Worlds has voted unanimously to accept Laconia's offers of protection and the coordination of trade. In exchange, High Consul Duarte has accepted the Association's requirements for self-rule and political autonomy. With this, Drummer killed the feed. Duarte had planned this, too. Not only the military campaign, but the story that made it something other than a blatant conquest. He came back because he thinks he can win. And if he thinks that, you should prepare yourself for the idea that it's true. Carrie Fisk would be on the news feeds of 1,300 worlds, worlds that Drummer was cut off from,
and the story she told would find rich enough soil to take root. "Self-rule and political autonomy," she said, "at the end of a gun? How does that work?"
"Tribute," Vaughn said. "A pledge of financial and resource support, if called on, but with very little suggestion that there will be occasion for it.
Plus the promise he won't kill the shit out of them, I'm guessing." Vaughn's smile was flinty.
"Fisk didn't make that explicit, but I think the implication's there, yes."
Drummer pressed her hand to her chin, stood up. Part of her wanted to send Vaughn to the med bay to come back with something to keep her awake. Amphetamines, cocaine, anything stronger than another bulb of tea.
"It's been a long day," she said.
"When the EMC's messages start coming through, tell them to calm their shit down and that we're going to address this."
"And for the board members?" Vaughn asked.
"Tell them the same," Drummer said as she walked out. "Tell him it's all under control."
Back in her quarters, she stripped, leaving her clothes in a pathway from the door to the shower. She stood under the near-scalding water, letting it run down her back and over her face. It felt wonderful. Heat conduction as raw, physical comfort. Eventually, she killed the water, took a towel to sluice off most of the moisture, and then dropped to her crash couch, one arm flung over her eyes. Exhaustion pulled down into the gel more powerfully than the spin of the drum. She waited for the despair to come. It didn't. The Union was facing an existential threat. The fragile fabric of human civilization in the colonies was ripping before her eyes, and she was relieved. From her first memories to the death of the Free Navy, she'd been a belter and a member of one faction or another of the OPA. Her brain and soul and identity had all matured with the inner's boot at her throat, at the throat of everyone she loved. The respectability of Tycho's station, and then of the Union, and now of the presidency, had been her dream from the start. The prospect of a belter reaching power equal to the inner's had guided her on, if not for her, then at least a belter like her. And, like all dreams, the closer she'd come to it, the better she understood what it really was. For years, she'd worn power and authority like it was someone else's jumpsuit. Now, with Duarte and Laconia, everything she'd built was falling away. And part of her was happy about it. She'd been raised to fight against great powers, to wage wars she couldn't win, but also couldn't lose. Returning to that now was a staggering loss, but it also felt like coming home. Her mind began to slip away, her consciousness falling into dream. History was a cycle. Everything that had happened before, all the way back through the generations, would happen again. Sometimes the wheel turned quickly, sometimes it was slow. She could see it like a feed gear, all teeth and bearings with her on the rim along with everybody else. Her last thought before forgetfulness took her, and she fell deeply into slumber, was that even with the gates, nothing really ever changed so much as repeated itself, over and over, with all new people, forever. Which, in light of the next morning's first meeting, was more than a little ironic. "We've never seen anything like this before." She'd known Cameron Tour professionally since she'd first taken a job with the Union, and he'd never registered as more than vaguely interested in anything. Now he sat across the table from her, gesturing with a tortilla like he was conducting an orchestra with it. His eyes were wide and bright, his voice higher and faster than usual, and she couldn't make out what the hell he was saying. Hot places in space, she repeated, looking at the schematic.
So, like stealth ships? Are you saying there are stealth ships waiting outside the ring gate?
No, 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 Tura said. Not that kind of hot. Not temperature hot.
Drummer gave a short, frustrated laugh and put the hand terminal down.
Okay, maybe we should try this again, like you were talking to a civilian. There are these areas we've seen that are...
What, exactly?
Well, Tura said, nodding more to himself than to her, of course you know that a vacuum isn't really empty. There are always electromagnetic waves and particles that pop in and out of existence, quantum fluctuation.
My background is in security and politics, she said.
Oh, right, Tour said. He seemed to notice his tortilla, took a bite from it.
Well, vacuum state isn't all just emptiness. There are always spontaneous quantum creations and annihilations. Hawking's Eldovich radiation that allows for
security, Tour. Politics and security.
Sorry. Really small things just show up. And then they just go away, Tour said. Much smaller than atoms. It happens all the time. It's perfectly normal.
All right, Drummer said, and took a sip of her morning coffee. Either it was a little more bitter than usual, or she was overly sensitive today.
So, when we turned all the sensor arrays on the gate, to try to get more information about the war and all that, there was interference we couldn't make sense of. It was like the kind we see when signals pass through the gates, but it wasn't localized there. It was out in normal space.
He pulled the schematic back up. Here, and here, and here, that we know of. There may be others, but we haven't done a full sweep looking for them.
But we never saw anything like this. And the logs make it seem like they may have appeared about the same time that the Laconian ship went through the gate, or when it fired at the ring station. We don't have great data on timing.
All right, Drummer said again. She was growing impatient.
It's the rate, you see. The rates of quantum creation and annihilation are... They're through the roof. The uptick is massive.
She was still struggling to get her mind around the idea that emptiness wasn't empty, but something about the awe in Tura's voice sent a chill down her back all the same.
So, you're telling me what, exactly?
That the space near the ring started boiling, Tura said, and we don't know why.
Chapter 20 Singh.
Santiago Singh spent a very unpleasant few days dealing with the fallout from his newly announced security protocols for Medina Station. One by one, every bureaucrat and functionary called him to express their concerns over how the crackdown might negatively impact morale and efficiency on the station. However the conversations were phrased, what he heard in them was always the same. The new rules will make people unhappy. They won't work as hard. Sabotage will increase. Are you sure we want to do this? His responses, however he put them, were also of a piece. I don't care if people are unhappy about the new rules. If they fail to do their jobs, they will be fired. Sabotage is punishable by imprisonment or death. Yes, I'm sure. In High Consul Duarte's seminal book on logistics, he'd pointed out that of all the methods by which one can exert political and economic control over another state, occupation by military force was the least effective and the most unstable. The justification for occupation of Medina Station was that, as the checkpoint of all 1,300 colony worlds, it minimized the need for any further military action, and let the imperial government move on quickly to economic trade and cultural pressure, which were much more stable, long-term strategies for exerting control.
and, in fact, demonstrating to the people of Medina that the Laconian takeover would lead to better lives for all of them was the test case. If Singh could convince a station full of people bred for anarchy that imperial rule was desirable, the still nascent colonies beyond the gates should be a piece of cake. He understood all of this well enough, but it didn't change the fact that he'd had to spend his afternoon explaining to stupid, angry people why attempting to assassinate the governor of the station carried consequences. When he cut the connection on what he hoped was the last of those complaints, he yelled out for someone to bring him coffee or tea or whatever else passed for a potable on that festering armpit of a station. No one replied, because Kasich was dead, and he hadn't yet brought himself to assign anyone new to his duties. As if by keeping the dead man on the roster, some part of him still remained that history hadn't erased. For a moment, the buzz of activity and conversation, irritation and confrontation that he'd cultivated since the incident slipped away, and he saw Kasich spitting raspberry jam that was really his brain and his blood and part of his tongue. Singh lost a few seconds. When he became aware again, he was on his knees next to his desk, vomiting into his trash can. From the state of the bin, he'd been at it for a while. The smell and look of the mess set off a new round of vomiting that only ended when his stomach clenched up painfully on nothing and a thin trickle of bile bit at the back of his throat. Delayed shock. Trauma reaction. It was normal, he told himself. Anyone would go through it. "I'm so sorry, Kasich," he said. Face suddenly covered in tears for a man whose first name he couldn't even remember. The comm unit on his desk politely beeped. "Leave me the fuck alone," Singh yelled at it. "Admiral Trejo is here for you, sir," a carefully neutral voice replied. "Here?" "In the security lobby, sir." Singh cursed under his breath, soft but vicious. He grabbed the liner out of his trash can and stuffed it into the recycler. The air probably still smelled of sick. He turned the air recyclers as high as they would run to cut it. "Put him through in 1 minute, please," Singh answered, then used the next 60 seconds to wash his face and rinse out his mouth. Trejo had returned to Medina. It could have meant a number of things, but all of them meant he wanted to have a face-to-face conversation instead of trading messages through the comparatively glacial security apparatus that surrounded official communications. And that meant talking about sensitive issues. "Sonny," Admiral Trejo said as he walked into the room, "you look a fright." "Yes, sir," Singh agreed. "I'm afraid that recent events have shaken me up a bit more than I expected. But I'm getting it secured. Shipshape and ready to sail, sir." "Have you slept at all?" Trejo asked. He sounded genuinely concerned. "Yes, sir," he said. And then, because it felt like lying, "Some, sir." "It's hard losing someone, especially someone you worked with closely."
"I'll be fine, sir," Singh said.
"Please, take my desk." Trejo's smile was sympathetic as he sat. He took the offered desk. "I have good news for you, at least. I passed along your findings on the gamma ray bursts through the rings, along with your recommendation about using a ship with an ultra-high magnetic field projector stationed in the slow zone to control access and passage. Naval High Command was very intrigued. They took it all the way to the top." The top meant only one person on Laconia. "I'm very flattered it got so much attention, Admiral." "He agrees with you," Trejo said. His voice had a flatness that Singh didn't entirely understand. His green eyes flicked up to meet Singh's gaze, and they stayed there. "They're sending out the Eye of the Typhoon.
It'll take a bit for her to outfit. She wasn't scheduled to come through for another 4 months, but you'll have her with all deliberate speed. She'll have Medina Station Defense as her official mission, but holding the ring system using your new data will be part of her parameters. Rear Admiral Song has that command, as I recall.
Yeah, that's Song's boat, Trejo agreed. But you're still governor of Medina. You'll have operational command over the defense of the station, and that includes determining when and if our new ring strategy is appropriate.
Yes, sir, Singh replied.
It'll be heady stuff, knowing an admiral has to dance to your tune, Sonny. Just remember that this posting won't last forever. Don't make any enemies you can't unmake.
There was a weight to Trejo's words, like they carried more than just what they said. They landed on Singh's chest like a gentle rebuke.
Understood and appreciated, Admiral, Singh said. Will the Tempest remain here until the typhoon arrives to take over?
No. We are moving up the timetable per your analysis. The Tempest is leaving through the Sol Gate in 4 hours, unless you've reconsidered your position.
Singh felt an offer in the question. This was the chance for him to say that he was out of his depth, that he needed backup and help. The temptation to claim perfect fitness was strong, but he couldn't dismiss the fact that he was, in fact, compromised. The question was whether his own frailty was enough to risk giving Sol System more time to prepare. The most dangerous part of the Tempest's mission in Sol System was the transit through the gate and the hours immediately after it. The longer the enemy had to exploit that period of vulnerability, the less the time he'd won with his discovery of the Gamma Burst would gain them. He didn't want to undercut the advantage he'd just provided. And still, he started to reply, but stopped when the bitter lemon taste of bile crept up the back of his throat again.
Not now.
He swallowed furiously, hoping this would be enough to hold off yet another round of vomiting into his trash bin. Trejo's eyes widened with what looked like genuine concern.
Sonny, Trejo said, have you seen a doctor?
Immediately following the attack, I sustained no injuries beyond a bruise on my knee and a bit of pride.
That's not what I mean, Trejo said.
I'll be fine, Singh lied. But Trejo didn't call him on it. I know that the ring emissions were never part of the defensive strategy before, but I find myself worried about leaving such a powerful tool behind.
Understood.
I'll be honest, I'm not totally happy moving the timetable up. Slow and steady, that's the strategy I like best. But there's nothing so far to indicate the locals have made any breakthroughs we don't know about. The High Council thinks we can afford to pull the Tempest out past the gate early. It does feel a bit like I'm leaving you here with your ass hanging out. But there is exactly one fleet in known space that possesses a threat to our plans here, and it's bottled up in the Sol System. You won't need to worry about defending Medina from it at all, because I'm going to force them to fight me on their home ground. I don't expect the colonies are going to cause you any trouble a destroyer can't handle.
I agree, sir, Singh said. We'll hold and wait for the typhoon's arrival, or word of your success in Sol, whichever comes first.
Singh expected this to end the conversation, and waited for Admiral Trejo to stand. Instead, the old man stared at him with thoughtful eyes until the silence had become uncomfortable. Etiquette dictated that he not close the interview until his superior dismissed him, so he stared back and tried for a vague smile. When Trejo spoke again, his voice was lower.
Tanaka filed her report.
She'll be boarding a shuttle shortly to take up a post on the Tempest.
Oh, Singh replied, hoping it came off as casual.
Don't misunderstand me. She's a fine operator, and her experience is more than welcome there. But if there are problems with her,
I would like to know what they are. I'm sure her talents will... Singh started, but Trejo cut him off without raising his voice. If she's going to take a command role on my ship, I'm going to need to understand why you removed her from yours, the Admiral said, his voice as gentle as though he'd asked for the time. That's what I'm asking you for.